This goes right inside the pocket.
See? I'll take things out of my pocket.
No, it goes right in, and you won't even know it's here. Thank you.
I don't like it.
Fine.
Thank you.
What's happening? An hour.
An hour.
Not sure. Why? You mean more or less? What do you mean?
An hour.
You mean don't cut it short. What's after me?
What?
What is after me?
Rabbi Yaakov Swati.
Oh, right.
Mr. Yaakov Swati.
Where is it?
In the room next year.
Okay. I don't want him taking pictures while I'm through.
During the
drush,
I said,
you're
going to talk to me.
Seems like that.
You'll leave? I'll leave. I'm hard if I give you. Don't think that's so I'm here to bother.
No. But I'm going to break the conversation.
Once you start speaking, I will be at the door.
I'm going to start speaking now. Right?
Are you going to make an answer?
I'm not making any answer. I'm going to shush everyone.
Okay, I would like to switch off your cell phone.
Okay, fine.
And I have a problem with that. Don't speak the whole time.
I'll
jump in. Can you
first block it open or block it locked? As far as I block it locked, people are going to push it open. It's easier if I block it open.
Lock it so they cannot.
I can't do that.
So can you put a chair?
I'll put a chair to keep it open.
Mind?
Yeah, no problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, in general, say as speakers request that cell phones be turned off. Unfortunately, there's in general someone who forgets to turn them off. Can I ask everyone to please turn your cell phones on, turn the ringers on as high as possible, so whoever's ringer goes off, they won't be embarrassed because lots of ringers will go off.
I don't approve of it.
I'm sorry, Rabbi Katz actually did request this stuff as we turned off.
Locked up? My dad is my phone. Okay.
If you're sitting at the back, if you move a little forward, it will help my voice. Okay, the subject that we're going to speak about is the problem of the sins of the great. In other words, how is it possible that people throughout Torah history that on the one hand were indescribably great, cosmically great, as is our understanding, they could do things that seem so very, very low, very coarse and very low. That's the format, but I'd like to try to show how a central tenet of Machshava, of Torah thinking in the area of free will can be used to understand this subject. In other words, all of us, all of you, people with backgrounds, you have a background in learning, you have access and experience, the Torah sources, perhaps perhaps even more important than the subject tonight is if we can try to demonstrate together how one of the most important principles in Torah teaching, and in my particular context it happens to be in the world of outreach, but in Torah teaching in general, it's always the application of the fundamental principles that is the tool that carries one through whatever area it is that you study. In fact, just as an aside, for those of you, someone complained or mentioned to me earlier that we were due to have a talk on outreach and kiruv, an effective presentation of Torah. Let me point out to you that there's probably no more effective method of teaching than to show how complex areas of Torah are always distilled down to the essence of a principle that is fundamental, that is seminal in the sense that it explains everything that comes thereafter. And of course the problem is, many of us feel inadequate in teaching these things. Many people in the so-called Frum world are afraid of outreach and working with people because they know that they don't have the keys to those subjects. Many people sitting in this room, I'm sure, it's going to be a long night. I'm sure that many people sitting here, many people with a yeshiva background, would be perfectly comfortable working out the halakhic area. If I asked you to tell me the halakhas of any area of Torah, even if you weren't familiar with them, I think you'd have a familiarity with the techniques and tools that are needed as to how you would proceed to research the subject, and you would follow it through from certain basics, and you'd come out confidently with some sort of conclusion. But if I asked you to work out for me the sugya of Bechira, or Emunah, or Bitachon, or Nisyonos, or any of the major areas of Torah belief or fundamental thought, many people with a solid Torah background, yeshiva background, would be very uncomfortable. And the reason is that we've never been taught the keys. Just like in Halakha, there are certain consistent keys and codes, processes, that underlie every Halakhic pattern of thinking. Similarly, in the area we call Machshava or Ashkafa, whatever you want to call it, in the agadic, non-halachic area of the Torah, there are consistent keys that unlock all those subjects consistently. And unfortunately, those are not widely known, they're not taught, and of course, one should always labor, as Rambam says, on the fundamentals much more than the details. If you get the fundamental principle, the details fall into place easily. Let's take a Torah subject this evening and try to understand its difficulty, and then take a step back and study a fundamental issue in one of the most fundamental areas of Torah thought and see if we can apply it to our subject and come out with an understanding. Who are you looking for, Bina? She's probably outside. Let's phrase the challenge and then we try to step back and understand it. The challenge is this. You have a serious conflict, a serious clash. On the one hand, we have people that we understand were indescribable in their greatness. By the way, this is a major issue in outreach. Right? People with a Torah background, very often, even if they don't have an intellectual or an academic approach to the subject, they have some sense of the subject. But when you deal in the outreach world with a tremendous misconceptions about Torah, and people are partially informed and they're missing certain basic principles, they have the most wild misconception in this area. And it's an area that needs to be addressed, and if you do it well, it's going to make an enormous difference. And the challenge is the almost impossible clash between Torah greatness on the one hand and the heinous level of crime and sin that those same people seem to have perpetrated. Example, you have David HaMelech, for example. So King David, on the one hand, is indescribable in his greatness. I mean, for example, there are sources that say that he was a man that only committed two sins in his entire life. Not bad, huh? I give you all here a personal bracha that for the rest of your life you should commit no more than two transgressions. Very good record. But on the other hand, those two sins were murder and adultery. Well, now, you know, how do you... What does that mean? Right? if that's the correct understanding. So people are tremendously bothered by these things. And usually, unfortunately, what happens in the secular mind is that the sin is taken seriously and the person's greatness is not. And so King David is demoted to the same level as the back page of the Sunday newspapers, the kind of thing that I wouldn't do. And you have the same thing with the sin of Adamarisha and of Adam. And wherever you look in Torah, you'll find the same misconception. As a person with that mindset that doesn't have the Torah approach, they'll read about the Jewish people in the desert being taken out of Egypt, and then the next moment they're bowing down to a golden calf. And, I mean, first of all, you can see the conflict that sets up. So the image that usually forms in a person's mind who approaches that subject is that these were absolutely ridiculously primitive pagan individuals, right? On a far more primitive level than you can begin to imagine. These are people who worship a lump of gold, calling it God. First of all, you have to understand, a person who does that, you have to understand this, a person who makes a shape of God, that means on one day he speaks to God himself, he faces Hashem face to face. The next day he bows down to a piece of gold, saying that it made him. Such a person doesn't have a religious problem, he has a psychiatric problem. Right? So how do you begin to approach such a thing? What happens is that those people are demoted to the most, and of course it ties in perfectly with the secular notion that history is a evolution, that we are going up. Which means if you project backwards, of course they were primitive. And of course in Torah we have exactly the opposite concept of Eurydice or Dairis, that things are going down. But they are convinced in their notion that things must be going up, because when you look back you find such primitive errors. And you can take any place you like in the Torah, you'll find the same thing. The sin of the golden calf, David HaMelech and Bathsheba. You can, when you look at the Reuben, for example, the Torah says absolutely openly that Reuben had an intimate relationship with his father's wife. You talk about one of the Shvatim. And Kaseda, throughout Tanakh, you find things that are so gross, so brutal, and so coarse, that there's almost no way to put this together with their greatness. How do we begin to approach this subject, right? And how can we apply a fundamental principle that gives clarity in this area? First of all, let's appreciate, before we take it apart, let's appreciate the problem. First of all, you know that as you look into this, it gets more complicated, more problematic. The Gemara says the following thing. Now, if you read about any of these incidents in Tanakh, you will find the most categorical criticism of the individuals concerned. If it's David HaMelech, you see the consequence, you see the punishment, you see the description the Torah has of what he does wrong, Adamarisha, wherever you care to look, you'll find that sort of description. The problem is when you turn to the Torah Shabbat and you look in and you see what the Gemara says about those averas, then it gets really problematic. And imagine a person new to Torah, you're trying to tell him that the meaning of Torah is what the Gemara says. And what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that if you say they sinned, you're making a mistake. Now, 1 second. Just one moment. The Gemara says, Kola Eime David Chata Eino Elatoya. Anybody who says that King David sinned is making a mistake. Just 1 second. Take the text enough and read what it says about David HaMelech. It's absolutely clear, not so clear what he did wrong, but it's absolutely clear that he made a terrible error. Then you read the Gemara, and the Gemara says that if you say he made a mistake, if you say he sinned, you're in error. So the beginner looks at this and says, this is absolutely cheap whitewashing. Here the rabbis coming along, they're taking the text, and they're saying that... Now, we who have a bit more insight, how do we understand such a thing? If the Torah says a thing, the Torah has to say it like it is. No question. The Torah has to be exactly like it is. The Torah is evidence. How can the Gemara come along and say that if you think the Torah means what it says, you're making a mistake because you never sinned? Or at least the sin was vastly different than what you imagined. And the Torah says it by Reuben, and it says it by David, and it says... The Gemara says it. Yeah, that's those things. How do you present this? Imagine a beginner. You're teaching a beginner, right? You're teaching a beginner. I'm sure you're all deeply involved in Kiruv, no? Aren't you? I mean, you're just taking a Pesach break, aren't you? I'm sure you are. I'm sure you spend 10% of your time, like when Moshe Feinstein says, you must have known with somebody new. Yes? So here you are sitting in your shul in Brooklyn or Philadelphia, wherever you come from, and you're sitting across the table from a beginner. Don't you do that every week? Of course, you should be. And they're asking you questions, and you're trying to explain this to them. So you read the text, and the text says that he did something terrible, and then you show him the Gemara, which is the interpretation of that. The Gemara says, you're making a mistake, you didn't do it. How do you begin to present that to a beginner? Where is the evidence? Let's take it a bit further. Which is true? Is it the text of Tanakh that's true? Is it the Gemara that's true? How do you put the two together? How can both be true? If you go a bit further, the problem gets worse. You know, we understand that we're in a phase, we're in a historical process that we call Yerida Taberes. The generations go down. Each sequence, each area of generations is on a certain plateau, and then there's a drop to the next set of generations, and a drop to the next one. And we have a picture of those steps of descent being indescribably great. We are now in the period that's universally called the Achronim. We have the last set of generations before Mashiach. If you go back to about the 15th century, you go back from there, from the 10th to the 15th century, you go back to the generation that's known as the Rishonim. Rashi, the Ramban, the Riv, the Rambam, etc. Those are the Rishonim. The step of voltage, the step up between us and them is indescribable. You know, the Gaon of Vilna, who died in 1797, who was again cosmically great, beyond any conception that we can begin to form. They once asked his star target, the Chaim Volozhin, people thought maybe the Gaon was so incredibly great you could compare him to the Rambam, who lived 500 years before. Now nobody loves anyone like a Talmud loves his Rebbe. And when they asked him if the Gaon could be compared to the Rambam, he said that if his Rebbe the Gaon would have studied for 100 years, he wouldn't have come up to the instep of the Rambam. Why? Because you're talking about a different category, a different league, right? A different league. I don't know anything about American sport. Well, I do. I know that you play football here, which is for real wimps and nerds with all that padding and all that stuff. Not like, you know, rugby. But I know, in Britain where they have football, you know, soccer, I mean, they're different leagues. And if you're relegated to a lower league, you just can't play the people in a higher league. You can play anyone in your league, and you may be hopelessly outclassed, but at least you can play. It's an axiom in Torah that you can't argue with anyone in a different league. It's axiomatic in Torah that if you want to differ with the Prophet Chaim, or you want to argue with the Gaon of Vilna, you're allowed to. You're out of your head, crazy, you're going to get macerated and decimated, but you're allowed to do it. But you can't argue with the Rambam, it's just axiomatic, you can't do that, you're in the wrong league. If you want to argue with the Rishon, you have to find another Rishon who says like you. And the Rishon can't begin to argue with an Amora, who lived 800 years before him. And the Amora never argue with the Mishnah, basically. Because the Tanaim... And when you go back each elevation or steps of generations, you're going to levels that are indescribably greater. But when you get back to the generation, the step up from the post-prophetic era to the prophetic era, then it becomes even impossible to say the words. The commentaries say that the step from prophecy to subsequent generations was like the light went out. You're talking about a level so great that there aren't words to describe it. So by the time you get back to those generations, you're talking about a greatness that is completely impossible for us to picture. And then you hear that people in those generations did things that you certainly wouldn't do. I mean, I don't know you all personally, but I presume that murder and adultery, you know, or... bowing down to a shape of gold. I mean, I presume that you're not habitually addicted to those things, at least. So, how do you give a beginner sense of this, by the way? What I try to do is, you have to use your own technique, but... The way I try to do this, I try to describe to a person, you have a beginner who has no concept of Torah history and Yerida Taberes. How do you begin to explain to him who they were? The way I find successful is, I try to describe to them some of my own experiences with the great people I was privileged to be close to. Right? For example, I mean, I had the privilege of being very close to Simcha Wasserman. It was my privilege, our families are related, had the opportunity to be close to him. And I describe to beginners sometimes some of the experiences I had with him. And then I tried to explain to him how he used to talk about his father. And how his father used to speak about the Chofetz Chaim. Even though, for example, now you're talking about Simcha Wasserman, you're talking about Misnagdisha and Litvisha, we're not talking Chassidus, we're not talking about Moskim, we're talking about... He would never talk to us about those things. Here's an example. One example. I had a question once that I wanted to ask him. Complex issue, many people involved, all the complexity. So I thought, before troubling him with such a question, I'll get all the introductory material organized so I could give him a little background. Then he'd know what I was going to, he'd understand the question. So it took me 4 days to organize my, so that I could get down to about a 20-minute discussion, not waste his time. And in 20 minutes I could give him all the variables and everything, and then I could go and present him, and after all that background I could then begin to explain my question. I'll never forget this. I went to his house in Yerushalayim. I knock on the door opens. I sit down at the table. I take a deep breath. I begin the first sentence of my introduction, and Asuka, with those beautiful, kindly blue eyes, he said to me, your question is? He said exactly what the question was. He answered it, end of conversation. I found myself outside on the sidewalk thinking to myself, why did he, I suddenly got the cold feeling that probably that was always the mode. Only normally, see this, normally, you know, let you ask your question. Here you could see it was going to be a long McGinnis. Right? So rather than have me sit through the whole thing, he said, on another occasion, I had the privilege of learning with him once a week. I used to learn my brother-in-law with his physician. So the two of us had the honor of learning with him once a week. In fact, we published a book on that. You should all read it. You should buy it, definitely. It's called Asuka Speaks. We took hundreds of hours of our sessions of learning with him and other sessions, and we simply collated the material and edited it. His own words. There's a little bit of cleaning up of the English and the grammar and a collation of subject material. It's amazing stuff. You have one of the great people of the previous generation talking about Kinuch, about Eretz Yisrael, about Mashiach, about Kabbalah, about amazing things. About the Chofetz Chaim, about Tshuva, about Kiruv. Rabbi Gordon, can you wedge that door or something? Thanks, appreciate it. So it's worth reading that book. I put it together with another fellow. We collated the material. We just organized it. It's an art school book called As Simple Speaks. But we used to learn with him. On one occasion, he would tell us often, you know, that was the approach, is that mystical or Kabbalistic things, it wasn't the style. It wasn't the style. We learned the whole of Mishlei with the Gaon. Whenever the Gaon came to deep, openly Kabbalistic things, he would skip over that. Unless the Gemara spoke about it. Then he would learn the Gemara with us. So, if you tell us why it's not suitable and we shouldn't learn that sort of stuff, then on one occasion, the two of us had an opportunity to learn some very deeply Kabbalistic material with a certain individual in absolute secret. You know, it was on a Friday night by candlelight in a hidden dark. I mean, nobody knew about it. It was a real secret stuff. And a week or two later, we sit down with our students. As we're learning, he looks across the table and he says to the two of us, Kabbalah? And he gave us a long lecture on why it's not suitable. Okay. About 2 years later, we've been learning through a lot of material, and we came across a sefer that I'd never heard of before. It's called the Leshen. The Leshen. It's a very, very little known. I mean, he was one of the absolute greats, and he's becoming much more known today. But particularly then, you're talking 10 years ago, whatever it was, more, or yeah, 15 years ago, it was, the story hadn't been reprinted. It was very uncommon. Someone who had some expertise offered to teach us. And we started learning that particular sefer. Changed my life, that sefer. A week or two later, we sit down with Rosh Simcha. He looks across the table at both of us and he says, Leshen. And then he proceeded to say amazing things. He said, you know, my father and the Chofetz Chaim both said he told us what they said about him, and he's tremendously approving, and he smiled at us, and that was the end of the discussion. I mean, now, the Simcha used to talk about his father, Rabbi Chanan, he didn't have words. I once heard him, the only time I ever heard him lost for words was when a beginner came into Osamaya and asked him to tell something about his father's greatness, the comparison of his level to his father. And Osamaya, he sat there for about 5 minutes trying to find some way to express to this young man, and he just gave up. And then he used to tell us what his father said about the Chofetz Chaim. And by the time you get back to the Gaon of Vilna, it's just impossible. There's just no words for that. So you start to give people, and you have to do it in this fashion. You give examples of people in previous theories, the way they, their greatness intellectually, their greatness. Rav Moshe Feinstein, I never had the privilege of knowing. But you come across some of the incidents. I mean, they're going to give an example. It's one example. This is very meaningful to me. I had a similar situation. I know how difficult this can be. Once there was a family in New York where the son wanted to go to yeshiva. The parents wanted him to go to college. It happens to the best of us. And they had an argument in the family. The boy was adamant he was going to yeshiva. The parents wanted him to go to college. So the father agreed to go and ask for Moshe Feinstein. He agreed? But the father knew who he was dealing with. He didn't see the rabbi. The rabbi's not going to say go to college. So he prepared himself. The father prepared himself. So they sit down around Moshe's table, the father, the mother, and the boy. And the father says, Rabbi Feinstein, my son wants to go to yeshiva, but my wife and I want him to go to college. And I'm going to prove to you why this boy should go to college from the Torah. Brave man, huh? I'm going to show you why, according to Torah, this boy should go to college. So my sister says, yes. The father says like this, look, the Torah says, he's telling of Moshe, right? The Torah says that every human being is formed from three partners. Every human being is a three-part formation. There's his father, there's his mother, and there's Hashem. That's how every Gemara says it. Gemara Nida. So this boy, he has three partners. There's me, his father. There's this lady, he's his mother. And you, Rabbi Feinstein, you represent Hashem. Now, I want him to go to college. His mother wants him to go to college. You no doubt want him to go to yeshiva. But the Torah says we follow majority. So of the three relevant components of this young man, there's a 2-to-1 majority that says he goes to college. And therefore, purely on Torah grounds, he goes to college. Nice try, huh? Listen to what Rav Moshe said. Instantaneously, he said to him, you're absolutely right. That every human being is made out of three parts, but you've got to think about that clearly. That means you have three parts to you. His mother has three parts, and so do I. Now let's think about it. Of the two parts of you, his father, who are your parents, no doubt the two parts of you that are his parents want him to go to college. But the third part, that's Hashem, certainly wants him to go to yeshiva. Okay. Now, of his mother, the two parts of her that are her parents probably want him to go to college. But the third part, that's Hashem, wants him to go to yeshiva. All three parts of me certainly want him to go to yeshiva. That's 5 against 4. The father said, on the spot, he said, if that's what they learn in yeshiva, that's where he's going. And he said that on the spot. How long would it have taken you to work out such a response? Huh? Okay. So you're talking not only about intellectual greatness, but this was a victory. Not this wasn't intellectual victory. This was a real victory. This wasn't just intellectually overpowering the father. This was converting the father. You're talking about... And then you go back to the previous generation and you go back beyond that. The Chofetz Chaim used to tell his boys on Fridays. Fridays used to tell stories. And the Chofetz Chaim told the boys once that his Rebbe, Reb Nachum, that when the Chofetz Chaim was 17, he once crept into the yeshiva to hide to watch his Rebbe learning when he thought no one was there. And when Reb Nachum started learning, the Chofetz Chaim said he saw found a fire around him. He saw a fire around Reb Nachum when he started learning. When they told the Briskerov that, the Briskerov said, the fact that a fire surrounded Reb Nachum is nothing, not surprising, but that the Chofetz Chaim could see it when he was under 17. Now, by the time you get back, when you get back to Rishonim, it's already out of sight. By the time you get back to Chumash, can you imagine? You have to show beginners, in Chumash, the way it talks about people, it says, for example, Avraham Avinu is sitting at the entrance to his tent, and it says, Vayisa'es Einav Vayar. He lifted his eyes and he saw. He lifted his eyes and he saw. That's a verse in Chumash. The Torah has to tell you that he lifted his eyes and that he saw. Why? You have to explain to them because he was under such intense control that every flicker of a movement was under perfect control. He first lifted his eyes, and if it was something to be seen, then he saw. But if it wasn't, he didn't see. It says, "My Moshil b'chol ha'shelo," it says by Eliezer. The simple translation is, he ruled over everything that Avram had. But the deep translation, he ruled over everything that he had. He learned that from Avram. He's talking about, Mufoshim bring down, when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, it says that he lived for 17 years in Mitzrayim, and when he died, Yosef kissed him. Yosef kissed him. Not the Mufoshim say on that? The fact that the Chumash tells us that Yosef kissed his father after he died, we can be Mosaic, who can infer that for the last 17 years of his life, he never allowed him to kiss him. No. This is a boy that he mourned for 22 years. And from the moment that he met him, until he died 17 years later, never let his son kiss him. You know why? Because the last time he saw him, he saw the receding into the distance the face of a young man that was absolutely pure. Talking about Joseph, Yosef. When he saw him 22 years later, he saw on his face that this was the face of a man who had once considered sinning with a woman. When Yosef was with Potiphar's wife, after all the intensity of her seductive attempts, there was a moment when he fell. And as he fell, he saw his father's face, and he was redeemed, and he never did the sin, and he ran out, great heroism, etc., with his life. But it had crossed his mind once to sin with a woman, and that was written on his face. Yaakov would not let anyone kiss him okay, who was the kind of person that had once crossed his mind to sin with a woman. It's all right. Now, okay, we could spend all night talking about these things, and of course one has to with beginners. But now the problem is compounded. If that was their level, then how is it possible that did the kind of things that they did? Let's talk briefly about a principle in free will that is a fundamental principle, and see if we can apply it to our subject. In the area of free will, which is probably the most important subject in Torah thought, and probably the most mysterious, deeply mysterious, paradoxical subject, tonight we won't have time to go into it thoroughly, but let's try to isolate at least one aspect of free will that we need for our discussion. And this not only is fundamental in Torah, but it's fundamental in showing how we differ radically with the modern conception, the modern psychological, sociological conception. That's tremendous explanatory power. And that is the famous principle known as Nekudas HaBechira, the point of free will. Let's try to speak about this briefly, get it clear, and see how it illuminates our subject. You know that we understand that free will is extremely limited. The Torah idea is that free will is limited in two dimensions. It's limited, if you like, in the horizontal plane, and it's limited on the vertical plane. Horizontally, we mean that free will applies only to one zone. If you look across all the areas of the spectrum of your life, the Torah axiom is that free will applies only in one area, and that's the moral zone. Free will applies only in the area of ethics or morality. In other words, where there's a battle between the more refined, elevated, higher self and the lower, more coarse, earthy, sensual, lazy, animalistic self. That is where free will by definition operates. In other areas of your life, in health for example, health, the right area of health, you can make all the right moves from a health perspective and you can become disastrously ill. You don't mean to be deemed sexually. In wealth, for example, right? Predetermined in Rosh Hashanah what you're going to earn, the seeding on what you're going to earn. You have no means of effect. You can damage yourself financially, but that's an immoral action. That's a sin. That's an avei, right? You do. That, of course, you can do. But you can't. You know, of course, we always, our immaturity always leads us to think we're free exactly in the wrong areas and deny it. Yes? Yeah, the interviewer said, so how did you make your millions? So, well, when I was 16, I just got up early in the morning, I worked many hours. You know, he's accountable for his wealth. Then they find him in some terrible moral indiscretion. And they say, you know, how did you do that? Not my fault, I was born that way. Ooh. That's exactly the opposite. Our teaching is, that's where you take accountable, and accountability, and financially it's not yours. Financially, you are not free. You know who put it very beautifully? Was Mr. Bronfman. Bronfman's from Canada? He owns one half of Canada, right? So they asked him, they interviewed him once, and they asked him how he became so wealthy. Mr. Bronfman said, I was 10 years old. Did I tell you the story? When I was 10 years old, I bought an apple for 1 cent, and I sold it for 2 cents. Then I bought two apples, and I sold them for 4 cents. Then I bought a box of apples, and I sold them for a dollar. Then my grandfather died and left me $61 million, and that's how I... That's an accurate understanding, right? That's a Jewish understanding. And I surely if the shiur is worth listening to, it's worth switching your phone off, isn't it? I mean, I'm hard to offend, but... Okay, okay. So in the area of wealth, you also don't have freedom, and you can go through various, even whom you marry, the opportunities are seriously limited. A young man, for example, cannot explore a relationship with every woman on earth, even though many young men are seriously trying. But there are serious limitations as to where your opportunities are. Where our teaching is, in the area of morality, in the battle between the higher self and the lower self, that is the zone where free will applies. And that's a well-known principle. But much more interesting and relevant to our discussion is that in that zone, you are free only on a particular level of a vertical scale. In other words, in any area of your life, whether it's the sensual area, whether it's the avaricious area, you like to take things that aren't yours, tempted to steal or to take advantage in some way, you're free only, as Rav Dessler explained, at one particular Nekudas HaBechira. Above that are things so refined that you guarantee to get them wrong, virtually guarantee. They're too difficult for you.
below your point of free will are things that are so easy that you get virtually guaranteed to get them right. And we don't really meaningfully talk about free will there. Right? And everybody has that point of free will. Again, you know, the problem is we compare ourselves wrongly in this area. We always tend that it's a reliable thing. Our immaturity leads us to look at the wrong end of the scale. What do? We look at people who are wealthier than us and wish we could be like them. We look at people who are morally inferior and feel superior that we're not like them. That's the wrong way to do it. You should look at people who are inferior financially to you and feel blessed that you have more, and look at people who are morally superior and wish you could be like them. But that doesn't suit you to do it that way. So you immaturely compare yourself in the wrong way. But you are free only at a particular zone. That's where you are. And everybody, a man once came to the Rambam, and he told him, Rabbi, I cannot say the confession on Yom Kippur. I've never done any of those things. Those are terrible things. I've never done any of those. The Rambam showed him how he was guilty of every single one at his level. Everyone in this room, all of you, all you decent, nice, refined, frum individuals, all guilty of stealing. You all have a problem. This Yom Kippur, you have a problem with stealing. So you're looking at me and you're saying, I don't break into people's houses at night with a black mask. And I mean, most of you, again, I don't know you personally, but I'm... That's not what we mean. That's not what we mean. There is somebody for whom that's a problem, yeah? If you make a scale, you make a vertical scale on the free will spectrum, you make a vertical scale, there is some individual down the bottom whose ordeal is mugging little old ladies on the street violently. That's his ordeal. And if that's necessarily that individual, next time he's walking down the street, and little old lady walks past with her purse, and there's a half a brick lying on the sidewalk, and he picks up the brick, and instead of killing her, he only maims her, says Rav Dessler, that's a tremendous moral advance for that individual. Because that's his level of free will. You couldn't handle that. You'd be sick of the thought. But that's not your problem. And by the way, it's not your credit. It's not your credit. It's somebody else's credit. Your parents, your grandparents, somebody else. But for that individual, but you sitting in this room, you have a problem with stealing. It may not be hitting people over the head with it. And of course, that's why you get no credit. You're only just at your level. When you go to the next world, right? When I go to the next world, Hashem says, Tats, what did you achieve in life? And I say, Hashem, I never hit any little old ladies over the head with a brick. You think he's going to say, very impressive, it's your curse. You're not going to say that. That's not my problem. I've got my own problems, I can assure you, but that's not one of them. You are judged. You in this room, how many people sitting in this room are employed? Okay. You work for someone. You work for someone in an office, right? You know if you make a private phone call, you're in big trouble? Big trouble. Two counts of stealing against you. You make a call at your employee's expense, and the 10 minutes you spent speaking on the phone, you've been paid salary to work. Now, if you work in a city where it's tacitly accepted that you can occasionally use the phone privately, that's fine. How about long distance? How about a 20-minute phone call? Something you wouldn't even register as problematic is full-on stealing. Let's say you'd never do that. You'd never do that. You're a little noisy and you wake your spouse when she's sleeping. That is theft and it's difficult to pay back. Right? That level of inconsiderateness. Do you know that halakhically if you don't greet someone properly, there's a counter stealing against you? Do you know that the halakha of a greeting has three requirements? The sefer panim yafos. You have to greet somebody, you have to look at them, you have to smile, and you have to register their presence intelligently. And you owe that to them. The fellow in the gata wouldn't relate to that. I understand what you're talking about. But you're accountable. There's a higher level. Do you know what nervous size is? If you mislead somebody in a way that is no way harmful, but it smacks at a subtle dishonesty about it, there's a total transgression. You know that? You're sitting at home. You're about to have dinner. You have an expensive bottle of wine that you're about to open. Unexpectedly, a friend of yours walks in. And you say to him, you know what? I'm going to open this wine in your honor. It's a lie. You're going to open the wine anyway. Now, no harm was done. On the contrary, you honor the person. There's a Torah infraction that you have just transgressed. That's called Gnei Vasar. The fellow in the gutter wouldn't know what you're talking about. But for you, you're more accountable for that than he is for what he's doing at his level of... Because the bigger you are, the higher the stakes are. The bigger the rewards are, the greater the dangers. Here's a test for you. Give you a test. Here's a real case test here for you at your level. This was put to one of the poskim recently. Here's what happened. Fellow walked into a bank in New York, asked to see the manager. Sat down with the manager, said, I want to take out a bank loan. Manager said, sure, how much? It's $200. Manager said, that's a very small loan. Guy said, look, I'm going overseas for 3 months. I want $200. You advertise loans. Manager said, okay, filled out all the forms. Said, you know you'll pay 20% interest? I said, yeah, okay. Then they get to the part about collateral.
So he said to the fellow, what are you going to leave us for value? Guaranteed.
The guy said, look, I'm going on the seas. My car's outside. I don't need it for 3 months. Here are the keys. You've got value. The manager said, well, it's worth more than $200. Okay. Fellow went overseas, came back 3 months later, walks into the manager's office, pays $240, picks up his keys and leaves. Manager says, to do me a favor, what was that all about? Fellow says, where else could I get parking for 3 months for $40? The question is, is that neighbor's us? That's a subtle question. On the one hand, he completely misled the manager. On the other hand, he didn't mislead him at all. He took out a loan, he left value, he paid interest. Tough question. See how you'd answer that question. Okay, but this is a question that's relevant only at the level. Do you see what's going on? You are free only. This is the famous doctrine of Nekudas Habetzel. If you play a sport, if you play tennis, tennis is meaningful only against someone who's on your level. If you play somebody that's vastly inferior to you, that's not... You're a tennis player, right? You play in your club. You can beat most of the people in your club. One day you walk out to the court, you find you've been challenged by a three-year-old. A three-year-old. He'd walk on with his racket and his diaper. And if you win that match, you know, that's just not meaningful. Yeah, your name goes up on the... On the other hand, if you play the world champion, and during the entire match you never see the ball once. You wouldn't go and tell your mum you lost. You didn't lose. You didn't play. That's not tennis is meaningful, says Rodessa, only against someone who's more or less on your level. There there's an exertion, there there's an effort, there's a failure or a victory. That what's way beneath you is just not, that's not called free will. What's way above you and you fail is also not really a challenge. You're not on that level. It's not realistic for you. And you're not punished for that. I'm talking about free will. You're damaged by the avera. I'm not talking about the power of the avera, yeah, or the benefit of the mitzvah. I'm talking about the lefum kara agra, the reward of the free will effort. That only applies where there's a free will effort. Incidentally, an amazing question is, when you find yourself at a particular point of free will, and you struggle at that level, if you ask the question, why are you at that level of free will, that's not your credit. That means all of you sitting in this room, all of you sitting in this room, the reason that your problem with stealing is not violent crime, it's not your credit, it's because you weren't brought up that way. You don't get the credit? Let's say you're brought up in a frum environment, okay? Frum, eat kosher food, keep Shabbos, no credit, no reward. You don't get the credit? Some parents or grandparents who came over to this country and sacrificed mightily so you could be brought up that way. And every time you eat a kosher breakfast, you get no reward at all. But some parent or grandparent, someplace in this world or the next, is getting all the credit for that. Because there's no free will effort for you, you're doing it out of habit. If you're a Baal Tshuva, then you're getting all the credit for that. Because you brought yourself in. And by the way, if you're a Baal Tshuva, says the Gemara, yeah, the person who goes out for lunch is about to cross the street into the local seafood deli, right? Lobster, crab, shrimp, not good. Not good. Suddenly, he stops and he thinks to himself, kosher food, you know, affects the heart, desensitizes you, etc. Maybe I should take this seriously. Doesn't like kosher food. Stands there shaking and sweating for half an hour. Decides to eat a kosher lunch. Amazing elevation. A spiritual value has overcome an earthly sensuality. Tremendous. Next day goes out for lunch, the battle doesn't last as long. Says the Gemara, by the time he's done this 3 times, no more reward. Once it becomes habit, he's elevated the point of free will, and he's now functioning out of habit, no more reward. Of course, there's always the benefit of the move they're putting there. But if there's no more battles, he's now beating the people in his club, he's now got to play the national players. When he beats the national players, he's got to play the international circuit. There's no more credit, there's no more tennis anymore at the level, he's outgrown that level of free will. He needs new battles now to remain in balance. And therefore, but the starting point is not your credit. It's an amazing thing to think about. You know that when you start out at a certain point of free will, you have to think about who's getting the credit. You know, when you start a process and the process goes on through the generations,
the credit is going back to the place where the free will effort was made. It's an amazing thing. You know, one of the questions that's asked in Kabbalistic sources is, you know that it says on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the living and the dead are judged. The living and the dead are judged. The Kabbalistic question is, why would the dead be judged every year? By definition, they couldn't be any different than they were the year before, right? Here's somebody's life. Imagine a lifestyle.
Person lives. At this point, their life ends. Next year, Hashem judges them again. Next year, Hashem... Why? They could, by definition, can't be any different here than they were the year before. By definition, being dead means you've got no more pain, cannot operate, no mitzvahs, no marriage. You can't be any different than you were the year before. Amazing thing, a number of answers to this. But an amazing principle exists. The reason that the Shabbos judged in the next world here, totally different than it was the year before, is because many things have transpired during this year that are the result of something they did back here when they were alive. Imagine somebody 355 years ago had a child. And the child had children, and the children had children. And there's 4,000 great-great-great-grandchildren in the world here during this year doing good things. Who's getting the credit? It's all accruing back to the account of some great-great-grandparents who began that process. The reward always goes back to the point where the free will was made. You know, I like to tell a story.
Some of you may have heard me tell it before, but a dramatic illustration of this. You sometimes do something that has consequences, and you can actually, I have an acquaintance who's a diamond dealer in New York. I met him when he came to South Africa to buy diamonds. And here's what I'm telling you, a first-hand story, right? This is not hearsay. What happened was, his mother was pregnant in the Warsaw ghetto, just before the Germans destroyed the ghetto. What happened was she needed to see a doctor. She managed to escape from the ghetto, and she went to see a lady gynecologist, old Polish aristocracy, Catholic lady gynecologist, city of Warsaw. This lady treated her, and when the Jewish woman was about to leave the office, the doctor said to her, if you go back into the ghetto, do you know what's going to happen to you? So she said, yes. She said, look, come and stay with me. So the woman said, I can't leave my husband. So she said, bring your husband too. So she said, but I can't leave my family. So she said, bring your family too. She went back into the ghetto. She told her husband that this Christian lady was offering to save their life. So the husband said, I can't leave my family. So they took them too. They arrived at this lady's house with 13 people. She put them in her attic for 22 months, including a time during which the Gestapo occupied the house. And for 22 months, they never left that attic once. And she took care of them with her own hands. There was no bathroom. There were no facilities. Nothing. For 22 months, she fed them and carried away all their waste with her own hands. Interesting things happened, it's a long story. 22 months later, she found an opportunity to get them across the border. All 13 survived, they all arrived in New York City. About 6 years ago or so, was a wedding of one of the grandchildren of one of those people. At that wedding in New York, were 200 people present, descended from the 13 people. At one time and place, at one chasana, there were 200 people present, descended from the 13 people that she saved, and they went back to Poland and they found her and they brought her to be present. The old, old lady at a Jewish wedding in New York City to see 200 people present, descended from the 13 people that she had saved. And during the meal, someone went up to her and they said to her, why did you risk your life to save Jews? And she drew herself up to a full height and she said, because I read Genesis. And in the Bible I saw that when Sodom was about to be destroyed, Abraham negotiated with God. And he said, if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom, will you save the city? And God said, yes. 45, and God said, yes. She said, and I hope there were enough of us to save Poland. And I was wrong. Okay. Now that is something to think about. Here this lady does an action, and out of that offending, I think 3 years ago I mentioned the story, and somebody stood up in the audience and said, I was there. I'm one of them.
Yeah.
So here's an action, and it fans out, those are all her children. Those are all her children, and their great-grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, those are all hers. So you don't take credit for where your point of free will is. You only take the credit for the shift you make. If you're brought up highly moral and refined and so forth, don't take any credit for that. Your challenge is, if you have natural talents, there's no credit in that. The credit is how you elevate your point of free will. That's the reason for being here. It makes no difference if you're born down in the gutter mugging people with bricks, or super refined with a deep refined... Makes no difference, that's not your credit. If what you do at that point is a meaningful application. This has tremendous explanatory power. Let me share with you just one insight that is fundamental. Let's look at the secular model and see the clarity this gives you. Example. I'll give you two examples. A friend of mine, who's a psychiatrist, some time ago comes to me and he says, I'd like to discuss a certain patient of his with me. Talk it over. He's got a 21-year-old Jewish girl who has a problem of compulsive stealing. It's a well-known psychoneurotic problem. She goes to the supermarket and she steals candy. What's the problem? He's helping her with therapy and she's getting better. The problem is she's now in court for the 10th time. And the magistrate, the judge, has asked my friend to testify about whether she's sane or not. If he tells the judge that she's insane, that means legally insane, psychotically detached from reality, she will not go to jail, she'll be sent to psychiatric reform. If he tells the judge that she's sane, she'll go to jail, it may well kill her. You're talking about a delicate, refined girl in South Africa in a jail, serious problem. He finds himself unable to tell the judge that she's insane. She's not legally insane. She knows what she's doing, she's fine in all other areas of her life, she knows it's morally wrong, she usually manages to control herself, but she sometimes fails. Now, how do you understand that? Is the girl free? Does kleptomania mean you don't have free will? What does it mean? Example number two. About 10 years ago in Central Park in New York, you must remember this, a young girl was jogging through the park, and four or five youths, or six, I don't know how many, they attacked her and almost killed her. They never stole anything. When the police picked them up, they told the police they'd done it for fun. Okay. This case became celebrated in the United States. You know why? Because the defense team led a novel form of defense. They said the reason that these young men should be acquitted is because they were brought up in Harlem. They were so disadvantaged, poverty-stricken, beaten, brutalized, abandoned, with such poor role models, with so many social disadvantages, that their behavior is entirely, in fact, technically what happened was the lawyers tried to invalidate the jury. They said, you middle-class whites cannot sit in judgment. You have no ability to relate to their problems. What they did is completely consistent with the background. And this caused an uproar in the United States because, you see, how do you handle this? Think about it for a moment. If you say that the ghetto background is irrelevant, you're an idiot. Right? Obviously, that disadvantaged background is highly relevant. On the other hand, if you say it's completely relevant, you can forget about justice and punishment and reward altogether, because then maybe everybody's action is simply the output that all the inputs condition. If kleptomania means you have no responsibility, right? Well, and therefore she should be completely acquitted because she has a compulsion. Well then, aren't all of us possibly acting out the results of our minor or major compulsions? But on the other hand, if you say she's 100% accountable, kleptomania is irrelevant, you're a fool. Obviously it's a problem. Obviously it's relevant. You don't walk into the supermarket and steal, I don't know you personally again, but you don't walk into the supermarket most days and steal candy. Why? Because you don't have that problem. So how do you answer this? The Jewish answer is so clear. It's scary the way they don't appreciate it. The Jewish answer is this. The fact that she has that compulsion is not her fault at all. Not at all her fault. That means when she walks in the supermarket and she sees the candy and she has a tremendous urge to take the candy, that's not her fault. That's her psychoneurotic problem. Is it genetic? Is it chemical? I don't know. Whatever it is, it's real. But when she puts out her hand and takes the candy, she's accountable. What she struggles with is not her problem. That's conditioned by all the inputs. Parents, grandparents, social security, United States government, whatever you care to name. All relevant, just like psychologists tell you. But the action you do, how well you play in that tennis game, which is up to your effort, that's up to you. Is this? These young men, when they stand in the park and they see this girl jogging through the park, their macho thing that they're going to go and beat her up and enjoy that's not their fault. That's not their fault. That's the culture they come from. But when they walk over and do it, they're 100% accountable. They're sensible enough to know that they wouldn't enjoy being beaten up with a lead pipe. You see what's going on? And therefore, all that modern psychology teaches you about the variables that impinge on our consciousness, etc., they're 100% valid. What do? They don't cause your actions. They cause your ordeal. They pitch you at the level of free will that you operate with. They pitch you here. You're not dealing in this room with people hitting people over the head with bricks. You're not dealing with that. But you're dealing with something. And that's not your credit, and that's not your debit. But what you do at the point of free will is the entire meaning of free will. Now, we could speak all night about this. Let's come back to the problem of sins of the great. Can you see where this leads? Can you see where it leads? Listen well. When the Torah says that King David has a sin, you know what it means? It means at his level. David HaMelech is fighting, is battling a realm of cosmic greatness that is beyond your ability to conceptualize. And at that level is his genuine level. And when he makes a mistake that is infinitesimal, had you been there, you would not have begun to appreciate that everything was done wrong. You would have thought it was the most amazing mitzvah. But at his supernal level, the Torah tells it like it is. Because criticism is only meaningful
targeted against the individual that you're speaking to. The Gemara means, what does the Gemara mean? You say David said you're making a mistake. You know what it means? If you say he sins, you, at your miserable level, you say he sins, what a chutzpah. But at his level, the Torah tells it like it is.
Rav Miller used to explain it like this, and Rav Miller from Gateshead.
Here's an example. Here's a fellow who works for Shell Oil. Shell Corporation, Shell Oil, 15 years old, he leaves school, and he gets a job on the ground floor of Shell Oil. Where's Shell Oil? Amsterdam, huh? New York, Amsterdam. So a high-rise building, major. And his job is distributing the newspapers on the desk and making tea and mailing the letters. His most responsible job every day is deciding in which mailbox he's going to put the mail. That's his job. One day he's walking around the office making tea, and he sees the headlines. In the headlines it says, Shell Oil to invest $75 million in Venezuela. The kid looks at the newspaper and he says, they're crazy, they'll lose all their money. Anyone paying attention to him? Of course not, what does he know? Shell Oil invests $75 million in Venezuela. 3 months, 3 weeks later, there's a coup in Venezuela. The new government nationalizes all assets, and Shell Oil loses $75 million. Here's in the headlines, and the kid says, I told them! Now, just one second. Think about that. Just think about that for a second. Before Shell Oil invested that money, you know what they did? On the 45th floor of that building, they sat up in the boardroom through the night, night after night. They heard testimony from the world's greatest oil experts, the world's greatest South American political experts, the world's greatest geophysical experts. They had excellent, the best information possible among geniuses and people highly trained and honed in their profession, and they decided the risk was worth it. And what happened? They were wrong. Now, let me ask you a question. Who was right and who was wrong? The board of Shell Oil were wrong. And the kid on the ground floor was absolutely right. But what a chutzpah. Do you understand? What a chutzpah. He doesn't begin to appreciate the state. Shell Oil guys in the boardroom, they got a pretty good record. Pretty good record, huh? They were wrong once. Were they wrong? Absolutely. And they're going to have to answer for it. When they meet their shareholders, boy, are they going to have to answer for it. The shareholders aren't going to say, well, you did a pretty good job, don't worry. Boy, this guy's heads are going to roll. Why? Because at their level of responsibility, they made a mistake. And they get spoken to at their level of responsibility. You don't speak to somebody, is this clear? Here's a first-year medical student. And he's standing at this brain operation, right? He's never looked in a skull before. Doesn't know what he's looking at. He's looking in the head, the patient's there, neurosurgeons operating, two world-famous neurosurgeons operating, and suddenly one of them makes a slip. You know what a slip means? His scalpel slips 0.3 of a millimeter. 0.3 of a millimeter. Less than the thickness of a human hair, and he cuts a nerve. And the other surgeon says to him, you idiot! You failure! You incompetent! And the first-year student says, yeah, you idiot! You... The first-year student didn't even see the nerve. If you showed it to him, he wouldn't see it. Do you hear the chutzpah? But the world expert criticizing his friend is 100% right. Because that's his standard. That's his standard. And critique has to be given at the standard of the person. You get called a success or a failure at your level. Not. You see this all over. You see it all over. Here's two children in the house. One's a mathematical genius. Never gets less than 100% for a math exam in his entire school career. The other kid never got more than 50. It happens. One day the two kids come home from school. The one who gets 100 got 99 on a test. The kid who got 50 got 55. You know what happens? For the kid who got 55, they make a kiddish. They make a kiddish. The kid gets a new bicycle and the father publishes the newspaper. The kid who got 99 gets marched into the bathroom and beaten the daylight out of. And the father says to him, you failure. You careless idiot. Why? Because he's speaking to a 100% child. This child's level is 100%. He was an idiot, a failure, a fool. He was careless. He spoiled his record. You criticize a person at his level. Do you know, by the way, that's why in a Torah school, grades are never read out in a classroom. Grades are never read out in a classroom. You know why? Because it's absolutely irrelevant to one child what grade another child got. What has it got to do with him? That child might, if you want a heartbreaking experience, and I hope there's some teachers present, if you want a heartbreaking experience, go to a junior school prize giving. You know when they give out the certificates and the prizes? A sea of little expectant faces sitting there. There's one, all little seven-year-olds waiting for a prize. You know what always happens there? There's one obnoxious, abnormal child who's probably got his brain irradiated when he was, unborn, who gets all the prizes. One gifted kid gets all the prizes. Next to him is sitting a little seven-year-old. His heart is breaking. Because he'd give anything to come home for a prize. He's not going to get one. So this kid, that's ridiculous. That's not education, that's assassination. They've all got to get to the beat. Right? The right way to educate kids is for the teacher to call the child over and say, for you, that wasn't good enough. That's not good enough. But it's not compared to some other kids. It's irrelevant. Our teachers tell us that when the child's 15 or 16 or 17, you can be brutally unfair. You know why? Life's unfair. They have to learn. So not when they're 7 years old, they don't know. When the whole self-worth and self-esteem and self-value is in comparison to somebody else. By the way, that's why the Gemara says that in the next world, you judge totally alone. The Gemara says that in the next world, each person has a totally isolated, you see no one else. From one perspective, you see, actually, the truth is husband and wife exist there as a permanent, eternal bond. It's good news for some of us, it's distressing for others. But the point is that, he that has it married, because they are one soul unit. But you don't see anybody else. You know what you see? What you could have been. That's what you see. Not what somebody else could have been. That's irrelevant. Obviously, a person is judged according to his... You know, Rabbi Victor Miller always used to point out, just to show you at another level, you know that it comes up everywhere. You ever have the experience of arguing with a Christian missionary? So the guy tells you, comes to your door and he says to you, you know, we're the chosen people now. I tell you that. We are now the chosen people. We're now the children of God. We're the children... You guys are not the chosen people. Why? Because God rejected you. You know they say that. In the age of grace, after their testament begins, you Jews got rejected, and now we've been chosen. And if you say to him, that is ridiculous, where did you find that? You know where he finds it? On any page of Tanakh. Because he can open the Bible any place he cares. And what will you find? You wicked, backsliding Jews, you murderers of widows and orphans. Doesn't the Torah say that? Every prophet. Read through the words of any novel you like. Virtually all of it is the most vitriolic castigation on the Jewish people. You know how hard you have to look in Tanakh for a compliment? Amazing, Hashem compliments us for following you into the desert. You have to look through page after page after page for one of those. The whole Tanakh, all the Nevi'im, is the most amazing, brutal criticism of the Jewish people. So the guy says, look, it's obvious. This is what your God says about you. It's total rejection. What doesn't he realize? He doesn't realize that Tanakh is a love letter between Hashem and us, where we function, we are His 100% people. When we fall to 99%, He's calling us failures because at our level, that's what's expected. But this character, nobody's speaking to him. You understand? You know what it's like? Here's this kid. This kid is a good kid. He's a good kid. He's developing well. And one day, it's all chutzpah to the teacher. Comes home and the father's absolutely incensed and he's punishing the kid like crazy. He's really taking it out of the kid because it's below the child's standard. The door opens and some thug from the street looks in and he sees the father punishing the kid. Thug walks in and he gives the kid a kick. Father says, what are you doing? The thug says to the father, you're doing it, aren't you? The father says, you idiot. I'm doing it because of how much I love him and what his potential is. You're uncorrectable. In other words, critique is always at the level that is relevant. And therefore, in summary, we've spoken long enough, the doctrine of the point of free will, Nekudas HaBechira, is the doctrine, the most fundamental doctrine, the basic assumption in our notion of free will. This is the great equalizer, right? The great equalizer. That is why we are all equal. Not because we're equal on an absolute level, that's irrelevant. That's why the Rambam says that every individual can be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. He does not mean in an absolute term, but that's not your job. You can be a tzaddik like him. Why? Because he achieved 99% of his potential. If you achieve 99% of yours, he was functioning there on the free will scale, you're functioning here. That's irrelevant. If you achieve 99% of your potential at your level, you call the tzaddik like him. And therefore, when the Torah critiques, when it talks about David HaMelech doing an Aveira, and if you go through the details, you'll find that Bathsheba was divorced. I don't have to go into, I'm sure you know all this. Uriah had a death sentence on him. David was mechuyav to kill him immediately. He allowed him to die honorably in battle. Instead of that, she was divorced already. David could see that the temptation, what was the temptation of Bathsheba when he saw her bathing, preparing for mikvah? What was his temptation? So you see, the modern ear hears it in the modern sense. What David saw when he looked at Bathsheba was Moshiach. Do you know what David's name is in the Kabbalistic sources? King David. Do you know what he's called in Kabbalistic writing? Bathsheba. He was the seventh midah that came down to the world, and he saw that out of them would come Mashiach, and in fact it did. Out of the two of them was born Shlomo HaMelech. Not bad for an Aveira. But there was something wrong. What did he do wrong? not easy to find out. There's two pages in the Gemara that tries to figure out what he did wrong. He asked for an averi, he did too soon, he had a relationship with... What he did is not easy at all to isolate. What did Adam Rishon do wrong? Had you been there, you wouldn't have begun to perceive the problem. But at his level, it was disastrous. And the Torah speaks to the professionals at his professional level. Okay, we'll stop there for this.
Thank you.